So in this particular posture, I describe this in three phases: body, breath, and mind. And I will guide you through this. Many of you this is familiar with, I'm sure. The first phase is all about body, all about posture. Posture is extraordinarily important in meditation environment. It's very important. And in this particular posture, if you're sitting on a chair, the invitation is to pull your back. Again, do what feels right for you, but the instruction slash invitation is to pull your back a little bit away from the support, so you're not leaning against anything. It's a wonderful metaphor. You're going to do this on your own. You're not leaning against anything. So the invitation is to stand out away from the back and to assume a very attentive posture that will itself invoke an attentive quality of mind. And that means starting from the ground, that your feet are, since most people are sitting on chairs, I will do it this way. For those of you who are on the cushion, I think you know what you're doing. Plant your feet on the ground. Feel the stability of this earth. Your body is your personal earth. It's what grounds you. So you want to feel your feet planted and connected to the, you could say, stable sanity of this planet. Rest your hands on your thighs. Feel the beauty of your own body. Treasure it while you have it. It's an anchor that will serve you to stabilize your mind. And your back is firm, but not stiff. It represents a quality of fearlessness, kind of a masculine quality, strength, immutability, dignity. And yet your heart center is open, receptive, and gentle. Kind of a feminine quality. So your very posture embodies the qualities you're trying to invoke with your mind, which is gentleness and fearlessness, hard and soft at the same time. Your shoulders are pulled back, so we have a good, attentive, upright body. You want to, from an inner yoga point of view, you want to straighten out the subtle body and its channels. Shoulders are pulled back. You want to align your head in harmony with your heart. We're generally heading in the wrong direction because our heads lead, our concepts lead. We want to put our head back in harmony with our heart, which usually means bringing your head back, rein it in. Join intellect and intuition, heart and head, with your very posture. In this particular practice, your eyes are actually open. The invitation here again is habituation to openness. You're not trying to run from anything. You're open to whatever arises, but your visual field is receptive, unfocused, open, just like your mind. Mind's eye, physical eye, same. Final refinements, you put your tongue on the back of your upper teeth. You part your lips ever so slightly as if you're saying the word ah. And you've created the ground, in many ways the most important part of the practice, with your body. Trungpa Rinpoche once said, if you just take the proper posture, sooner or later, you will find yourself meditating. So with this foundation, we move to the breath. Very simple. You simply feel the natural movement of your breathing. It's literally the movement of life. If you're alive, you're breathing. If you're dead, you're not. We are one breath away from death. Breathe out, don't breathe in, you're dead. So the instruction here, you don't visualize it, you don't imagine it, you simply feel it. Feel the natural movement of your breathing. Bring your awareness to your body and your breath. And then lastly, mind phase. Whenever anything arises that distracts you from your body or your breath, whenever anything steals your awareness, image, thought, fantasy, doesn't matter. Whatever distracts you, you label. Very gentle, very precise, like popping a bubble with a feather. You simply recognize that your mind has moved by saying, mentally, thinking. And then back to the breath. Thinking, back to the breath. Thinking is not a reprimand. You're not trying to stop anything that arises in your mind. You're merely practicing the act of recognition. You're literally exercising the muscle of awareness. Thought arises, thinking, back to the breath. So we'll do this for a few minutes. So now I will talk you, I will guide you through our first reverse meditation. So all reverse meditations, we'll do several this weekend. All the reverse meditations are practiced within the container or context of this basic shamatha or sitting meditation, which creates a kind of crucible, kind of sanctuary of sanity, you could say. A sanctuary of sanity that is large enough to contain any experience. And with the reverse meditations, it's unwanted experience. You need a big crucible, you need a big mind to relate to unwanted experience properly. So in this one, which by the way, these come from the tradition, I am not making these up. The first one is a pain meditation, and again, very individual, you become your own meditation instructor here. You have to kind of titrate your own experience and see what works for you. You don't want to become a masochist. You want to establish a relationship to pain. You will never, as long as you have a body, you will never get rid of pain. Pain is a lifetime companion. But you can get rid of your suffering. They're not the same. Suffering is an inappropriate relationship to pain. I use the equation as a bit of a mathematician. S equals P plus R. Suffering equals pain plus resistance. Drop the resistance, you drop the suffering, you're left with raw pain. It still hurts, but it doesn't hurt the same way. It just becomes awareness. It just becomes intense, heightened awareness. So the way we do this is for a minute or less. Again, whatever feels right for you. Dig your fingernail into your thumb. Bite your lip, bite your tongue. Don't be silly, don't hurt yourself. But you want to explore and establish a relationship to this thing we call pain. And we do so by doing the opposite of what we normally do, which is to run from it. Here, we're allowing ourselves to go into it. Jon Kabat-Zinn has made an entire career out of this, mindfulness-based stress reduction. The largest form of clinically based meditation in the world comes from this basic theme. So starting now for the minute, bite your lip, bite your tongue until it hurts, and then just go into the pain, explore it. What is pain, really? What is it made of? What is this thing called pain? Maybe lean into it for another 5 seconds. Amp it up just a little bit. And then release, let it go. If you become one with your pain, then there's no one to hurt. There's just pain. This is important when we start talking about the painful bardo of dying. This will prepare you for sickness and death. One more time. The key with reverse meditations are short sessions repeated frequently. Otherwise, you'll never do this. Bite your lip, bite your tongue, dig your fingernails, whatever, without really hurting yourself. Go into your pain. What is it? Can you actually relax into your pain instead of defensively contracting around it? The contraction creates the suffering. Can you say yes to this unwanted experience? Is your mind and heart big enough to hold it? Lean into it a little. And drop, relax, open. Do you have a preference for one state over another? Can pain and pleasure truly be ornaments which it is pleasant to wear? For the Buddha as it is. One last time. Just for fun. It's said on the spiritual path that as you progress on the path, you feel things more, but they hurt you less. It's as if you're not giving this sensation a place to land. It's just awareness. It's just heightened, intense, pointed, sharp awareness. Can you relate to it as such? Lean into it, a little crescendo. Can you relate to both experiences the same way? Can you relate with equanimity to both? Are they the same? Do they have the one taste quality that they have for the mind of the Buddha? No preference. Okay, now you can just lean back. I will guide you through the first of the four reminders, which is very brief, and then we'll chat. And then I'll say a few more things about this pain meditation and how it's really changed my relationship over the last 15 years. So these four contemplations, which we'll have out here for you, are seminal reflections written by the great tantric Buddha Padmasambhava, sometimes considered the reincarnation of the historical Buddha. He's the genius that brought Buddhism from India to Tibet. So he's a kind of the patron saint of Buddhism in Tibet, a giant, to put it mildly. And he wrote these things really as a kind of, I see them as a liturgical analog to the trips that the Prince Siddhartha took outside of his palace that converted Siddhartha into the Buddha. You know the story of Siddhartha's life? You know the prince who had all the things that we would covet in the West, a life of palatial luxury. And then what basically transformed Siddhartha into the Buddha is he left at age 29. He was sequestered by his father into his palace, so basically his father tried to protect him from reality. And at a certain point he said, yeah, there's something missing here, you know, this is pretty sweet, but it's, you know, giving me a psychic cavity. Pardon the dental metaphor. So he basically went outside the palace, and the first time he saw aging for the first time. It's hard to believe, but it's a, you know, mythological story. Probably true, but who knows? He saw aging for the first time, and it really disturbed him. Really disturbed him. Went out the second time, saw sickness, lepers or whatever in India. There's no shortage. To me, it's no surprise that some of the greatest contemplative traditions were born in India, because if you've ever been there, they don't hide their suffering. You know, when you're in India, you know, you want out. Those of you who have been there. So it's interesting how many great religions and spiritual traditions came where reality is so raw. So he came out, saw sickness, came out the third time, of course, saw death. And these sojourns really shook him. And they basically turned him from what's called an outsider into an insider. The word for non-Buddhist in Tibetan is chipa, transliteration, C-H-I-P-A, literally translated as outsider. Those who are looking for love and happiness in all the wrong places. Outside. You're looking outside for conditional happiness through fill in the blank, money, sex, power, drugs, the Western way. That ain't gonna do it. Those are all substitute gratifications. You will never find happiness outside because you're looking in the wrong direction. Buddhists are the word for Buddhist. Anybody know? Do we have any Tibetan scholars? Yeah. Yeah. Rere. Nangpa. N-G-A-N-P-A. Nangpa. Which means? Insider. Insiders. Buddhists, isn't this interesting? Buddhists are literally insiders. As Sylvia Boorstein said so playfully, those are the ones who realize that happiness is an inside job. You will not find happiness outside. You will find temporary respite, but you will not find absolute happiness outside, because all our outsiders' happiness is based on conditions. It's what we call conditional or conventional happiness. It's based on conditions. When everything comes together, the sun is shining, your belly is full, your bank account is great, you just fell in love, I'm happy. But then what happens is you strive to reinstate the very conditions that brought about that. That's the definition of samsara in the Western world. That's what advertisers are designed to do. And then when those conditions are not met, which of course they sometimes will not be, then what happens? Instead of finding happiness, you find frustration. So you will never find what you're looking for outside there. These are all substitute gratifications, temporary respites. Parenthetically here, this one, you should write this one down. This will save you a crap load of money. We confuse the satisfaction of want with its temporary transcendence. This will save you a lot of money. We confuse the satisfaction of want with its temporary transcendence. And what this means, and I invite you to take a very close look and see if this isn't true. What this means is that we think we're happy when we get what we want. Hence, we spend the entirety of our lives doing what? Pursuing the conditions that we think will make us happy. But if you take a very, very, very close look at what's actually happening, what constitutes true happiness is the cessation of want. In other words, at the moment you get what you want, what has happened? You're no longer grasping. So look at the mechanics of happiness. Look at the mechanics of grasping. Look at the mechanics of your desire, and you will save yourself a ton of money. Because the moment of satisfaction is nothing more than the release of grasping. Isn't it? You get what you want, what happens? For a little bit, there's a respite. There's a moment of relaxation. There's a moment of release. That's the happiness. But we confuse that, we conflate that with the object or conditions that brought about that state. Hence, we spend the entirety of our lives trying to reinstate or procure more of those things or states. Does this not define the entire Western approach to happiness? Marketing, sales, you name it. This is the Western trajectory of the world, the cheapa trajectory. You're looking outside. It ain't never going to work. This is why the billionaires, you know, the lives of the rich and famous, look at how much suffering is really going behind that iron curtain. So this is why billionaires can suffer and why, you know, I work a lot in Asia where people make less than a dollar a day. These are some of the happiest people I know. It's not dependent on what happens out there. So the four reminders are four thoughts that turn the mind. They're designed to turn the mind from chipa to ngangpa, so you're looking in the right direction. And one of my teachers, Choki Nimba Rinpoche, said, and when he first said this, I thought it was hyperbole, but it's not. It's really true. He said that if you take these four reminders to heart, these four thoughts that turn the mind from chipa to ngangpa, 50% of your spiritual path is complete. Because you're finally giving up hope for samsara. You're finally realizing the utter futility of trying to find happiness outside. You're starting to point your mind in the right direction. I thought he was exaggerating, but it is true. As a meditation instructor and as a doctor dentist, I often feel like I'm writing prescriptions to my meditation students because they come to me complaining about blah, 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 blah. And I often feel like I should break out my prescription pad and say, okay, RX, reminders, dispense four, SIG, recite daily until renunciation takes place. It's truly, 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 truly it. So these talk about perspective generators. You'll see we go through these things. These are all about pointing out, they're just basically descriptions of reality. They're descriptions of the futility of karma, trying to find happiness outside, the reality of death. They're basically very powerful reminders, and they're reminders because we forget. Forgetfulness takes place not only moment to moment, but at the level of an entire lifetime. We can waste and forget an entire lifetime. These teachings point us in the right direction. So here's the first one. I'll recite these to you over the next four sessions, and then, you know, I strongly recommend you memorize these things, and then do what you need to do to translate them into a vocabulary that speaks to you, which I do. I memorize the text classically, and then I go, okay, how can I translate this so it speaks to me? And maybe I'll share some of my personal translations. So here's the first one. Contemplation, remember, hearing, contemplating, meditating. So far we've done hearing, a little bit of contemplating, you're thinking about this stuff. We've done a little meditation. Here's formal contemplation. So here's the first one. Contemplate the preciousness of being so free and well-favored. This is difficult to gain, easy to lose. Now I must do something meaningful. And usually with a practice of contemplation, if you haven't done this, it's a form of analytic meditation. You repeat it, you really mull it over. You know, this is the digest phase, right? So you're chewing on it, you're thinking about it, you're mulling it over. You're trying to drive it into your system. Contemplate the preciousness, the extraordinary preciousness of being so bloody free and well-favored. You're not in Afghanistan. You're not in South Africa, Central Africa. Your life is extremely free and well-favored. Contemplate the preciousness of being so free and well-favored. This is difficult to gain, so easy to lose. Now I must do something meaningful. Contemplate the preciousness of being so free and well-favored. This is difficult to gain, easy to lose. Now I must do something meaningful. Okay, that's it. Short and sweet. So I am now going to talk to you. We're going to set the direct preliminaries for these Bardo teachings altogether. And we're going to start by discussing what is kind of the organizational template, the doctrinal template for all these Bardo teachings. And we're going to start by talking about what's called the universal process or the Trikaya. There are three central, they're called orienting generalizations. That's a good term. Orienting generalizations. These are the archetypal templates, the GPS. This is the kind of the hardware of the GPS that we're installing. And there are three of these that we're going to talk about. I'll get through one or two of them now, and then we'll come back after lunch. And this is really quite beautiful. I came across this. You may remember this quote. If you can tell me who this came from, I was going to say I'll give you a free book, but I'm too cheap. To the well-organized mind, death is but the next great adventure. Who said that? To the well-organized mind, death is but the next great adventure. Not quite. Somebody more profound, believe it or not. Dumbledore. From Harry Potter. Yeah, not bad. I read that, I said, way to go. To the well-organized mind, death is but the next great adventure. What we're going to be doing with these orienting generalizations is we're going to organize the mind so that this does become the next great adventure. This does create the GPS. So there are three of these central orienting generalizations that we're going to unpack. One is the painful Bardo dying. That's Bardo number one. And we'll define it, obviously, a lot. I'll go through all the stages and everything. That's what's coming up. That ends in death, at the moment of death. At the moment of death, you will be exposed to the nature of your awakened mind. You are heading home when you die. It's a homecoming. You're going to descend into the nature of the awakened, enlightened mind. With that view, I mean, talk about a view. And this is why I mentioned last night, the highest practitioners look forward to death, not in a suicidal fashion, but because they know where they're going. So the second Bardo, this is called the luminous Bardo of Dharmata. Dharmata, the luminous Bardo of Dharmata. Dharmata is a Sanskrit word, basically means suchness, isness, reality. It's a luminous Bardo of the awakened mind. And it's extraordinarily subtle because enlightened mind is very subtle. The entire Tibetan Book of the Dead is basically, half of it's devoted to this Bardo. For most of us, this Bardo happens in a finger snap. For us, it's associated with our level of recognition of deep, dreamless sleep. How many here, you know, you think lucid dreaming is a little bit tricky. How about lucid sleep? There are sleep yogas in this tradition where you can maintain consciousness, 24/7 consciousness, where the mind literally never turns off. The mind of a Buddha, literally the awakened one, literally etymologically the awakened one, Buddhas, the mind of a Buddha does not fall asleep. The body reposes, goes into rest to reconstitute the elements, but the mind never turns off. So the mind of a Buddha never shuts down. So the luminous bardo dharmata, to get an intimation again, based on last night's experience, I can infer I'll have a hard time in the bardo tomorrow. If you don't recognize deep dreamless sleep, which most of us like, are you kidding me? Like, that's like the epitome, that's the apogee of ignorance. You will not recognize the luminous bardo dharmata. But that's the nature of your mind. That's what you drop into every night. This is the common bed. We all share this bed of mind. We all sleep together every night. When we drop into deep dreamless sleep, we're dropping into this bed of mind. So the luminous bardo dharmata is all about that, and this is where you're going when you die. Most of us will not recognize it because it's formless. I'll talk more about this later. It's too subtle. It's formless. We do not identify with formless awareness. We identify with the forms that occupy and appropriate that awareness, i.e. things. So what happens is then, third bardo, we don't recognize it. We could say we black out. It's a total blackout, just like deep dreamless sleep is a blackout. And the next thing you know, you wake up. And actually for most non-practitioners, you don't recognize this either. It's just like a non-lucid dream. Karma reignites. You're propelled out of your body. You take on a mental form, just like in a dream state. You wake up in what's called the karmic bardo of becoming. Usually when I teach that, everybody, when I first taught this material, when I taught the luminous bardo dharmata, I felt like I was looking at a bunch of deer stuck in headlights. Everybody was like, and the minute I finished, they like ran for the door. And I was like, oh my God, I felt really bad. And then I said, there's another slip. This is a perfect metaphor. It's exactly what happens in the bardo. You know, we can't relate to the teachings just like we can't relate to the experience. So we run for the door. And when they ran for the door, I said, this is beautiful. This is exactly what happens after death. They run for the door of karma. Karma propels them out of that state, and they run for something that's familiar, which is karmic confusion. So after the luminous bardo dharmata, which is the radiant display of the awakened mind, where all heaven breaks loose, we don't recognize heaven. There's too much power here, too much beauty, too much elegance. We're not familiar with it, so we run from our own power. We're afraid of our own power. So we run from that, desperately seeking refuge in something which we are familiar with, which is karmic confusion. So we run from that into the karmic bardo becoming. And when I start teaching this program, everybody starts nodding their head again because we're talking about the display of ignorance as it manifests on the backside. And I have a little diagram, a little triangular diagram that represents these three bardos, which we'll talk about. Kind of an hourglass thing. In the karmic bardo becoming, all hell breaks loose. All heaven breaks loose in the bardo of dharmata. We're not familiar with heaven, so we run from it. We run into the karmic bardo becoming, where all hell breaks loose because karma is unleashed in unmitigated fury. Second half of the Tibetan Book of the Dead describes this. And then, of course, if we can't stand the onslaught of our own mind, we run yet again from that. Usually completely unconsciously, without control, the winds of karma then blow us involuntarily into what? Another life, again and again and again and again and again. For hundreds of trillions of lifetimes, we've been going through this cosmic recycling. Until we catch on doctrinally and experientially, unfortunately, the teachings are not very, they're a little bit wrathful here. You know, it's just reality. It's not like, you know, there's nobody going to save your non-ass in the bardos, according to this tradition. You have to save yourself. Nobody's going to do it for you. That doesn't mean you can't call on help. That doesn't mean through the power of your devotion there aren't entities and forces that can help you. For sure there are. But unless you engage in some preparatory practice, just look at what happens every night. You'll get a taste of what's going to happen after you die. Oh my God, it's so depressing. So those are the three orienting generalizations in relation to the bardos altogether. The two that we're going to start talking about, one now and one after lunch. The first one, the next one I'm going to talk about, the kind of doctrinal template for all the bardos, is what's called the Trikaya, T-R-I-K-A-Y-A. Literally means three bodies. I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about that And then the last one we're going to talk about is not as strictly, this is where I'm going to take a little bit of a stretch. This is not strictly a Buddhist description, but I have used it, and it explains to me more elegantly than anything I've come across what happens through this entire kind of cosmic cycling of life and death altogether. And this is a teaching that has its origin in Plotinus, the great Western mystic, when he talked about, do we have any philosophers here? He talked about what's called efflux and reflux. Sri Aurobindo talked about it. Ken Wilber picked it up, talks about it. This is called the process of involution and evolution. And I'm going to talk to you about that after lunch, because that's kind of an application of the Trikaya in a graphic form that has helped me tremendously understand this entire play of life and death.